You are listening to a sermon by Ewan Russell Jones, recorded on Sunday, March 15th, 2026, at Point Grey Intermennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speakers are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgmf.org.
Yeah, well, hi, everybody. It's very good to be joining you from Wales. It's 5 in the evening here, or just after now. And so it's great to be joining this. The reading for today, the long reading, happens to be from John's Gospel, and it's a great reading. So this reading addresses a theme. John 9 addresses a theme which is central to the whole Gospel, the contrast between light and darkness, perception and ignorance, truth and illusion. It tells the story, a story about the glory of a revelation and a grubby human conspiracy to conceal and cover it up. It's a story that's 2,000 years old, but like so much else in the story of Jesus, it couldn't be more relevant to the times in which we live. Jesus encounters a man who's been blind from birth. We don't know quite how it happens. Jesus and his followers are clearly walking through the city of Jerusalem, and perhaps they just notice him by the roadside. He's probably begging. We learn later on in the reading that he's a beggar. And of course, that's something that blind people were often driven to do out of desperation, that being their only kind of means of getting some money. And his condition clearly raises profound questions for the disciples who were with Jesus. Rabbi, they say, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? They assume, along with many others of that time, and some, of course, in ours as well, that disability and afflictions of various kinds must be a sign of divine punishment for some kind of wrongdoing by him or his family. But Jesus will have none of that. He explicitly rejects the notion that the man's blindness was caused by his or his parents' sin. Instead, he says, this happened so that the works of God might be displayed in him. As far as Jesus is concerned, this is an opportunity in this moment for the reality and power of God to be made manifest in his life. And it's at this point that Jesus repeats the remarkable claim that he'd made in the previous chapter, actually, John chapter 8. I am the light of the world. I am the light of the world. Whoever walks in me, in that light, will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. That's John chapter 8. And then here it says that as long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. But it's the same, that same central statement. Jesus identifies himself as the one who can bring sight, healing, and light to this man and to the wider world. And this whole account of the gift of sight to a man who was born blind is a demonstration of the truth of this astounding claim and what it means. The miracle happens very, very simply. Jesus just spits on the ground to make mud, which he smears on the blind man's eyes, and then he sends him off to wash in the pool of Siloam. And that's a name which actually comes from the Hebrew word meaning to send. The pool of Siloam is the pool of sentness, of being sent. And this man clearly is on this occasion. He does as Jesus tells him, and he's soon able to see. It's a very simple, quiet process, but the result is dramatic. And as might be expected, the healing creates quite a commotion. The locals who've passed him regularly in the street can't believe it. Surely this isn't the guy who used to sit and beg, they say. It can't be him, can it? Yes, it can. It's me, he says. I'm the man. And he goes on to tell them what Jesus did. The disturbance comes to the attention of the religious leaders, the Pharisees, and they want an explanation from him of what's happened, which he gives them. But far from being delighted and amazed at his story, delighted with him, he's now able to see, some of them are very worried, quite cross. Some are very concerned that Jesus did this healing on the Sabbath day. He can't be from God if he doesn't observe the Sabbath. The Pharisees don't believe that the man has really been blind from birth, so they call in his parents to give them a grilling. But the parents confirm that this is indeed their son and that he was, in fact, born blind. But they refuse to answer questions about how the healing happened. They're aware that Jesus has a reputation by now as something of a troublemaker. He's obviously come to the attention of the authorities in Jerusalem, the religious authorities, because of his teachings, and they're afraid of the consequences of being associated with him. So they say, ask our son yourselves. He'll tell you. And that's as far as they'll go with these inquisitors. So the man is hauled back before this religious tribunal for a second time. And now they really ramp up the pressure on him. Give glory to God, they say, not to this man Jesus. We know he's a sinner. But instead of backing down, he becomes increasingly outspoken and defiant, not just about what has happened to him, but about the character and identity of Jesus, the man who healed him. I don't know whether he's a sinner, he says, but I do know this. Once I was blind, now I can see. That's fantastic, isn't it? Once I was blind, now I can see. It's kind of incontrovertible. He's born blind. Once he was blind, but now, because of what's happened, he's able to see. The authorities become more aggressive and hostile at this point, angrily accusing him of departing from the faith of Moses and of being a disciple of Jesus. The man stands firm, however, and his faith in Jesus actually seems to grow under all this pressure. You'd think he'd kind of wilt, but he doesn't. Here's the thing, he says. You don't know where he comes from, and yet he opened my eyes. Never since the world began has it been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a person born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. Extraordinary kind of sense that he has already that Jesus is special, you know, that what has happened is testimony to something in Jesus, something to do with him and his character that speaks profoundly. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. And that's too much for this religious tribunal. They can't stomach this talk about Jesus, and they throw the guy out of the hearing. Jesus gets to know about all of this and he goes to find the man because obviously there's been no contact since he sent him off to the Pool of Siloam. And he presumably the chap hasn't even been able to go and say thank you or tell him what's happened. But Jesus asks him if he believes in the Son of Man, the Messiah. When the man asks in return, who this might be, Jesus tells him, you have now seen him. Think about that. You know, you've now seen it. I smeared the mud on your eyes. I sent you to the pool of Siloam. You have now seen him. In fact, he is the one speaking with you. It's a real kind of self-revelation from Jesus of his identity. The healed man declares his faith in Jesus. Lord, I believe, he says, and he worships him. Lord, using that title that's so packed with significance, is a beautiful story about the opening of blind eyes. And of course, it's about far more than the gift of physical sight. In his encounter with Jesus, the man's eyes are opened not only to the material world, but also to the truth about Jesus. His encounter with the Pharisees and the religious authorities, on the other hand, demonstrates their resistance to Jesus. And as the story unfolds, we're led to ask, who's really blind here? Who are the ones who can see? Who are the ones who are trapped in the darkness? There's a short story by H.G. Wells that I read way back in high school, but I couldn't help thinking about it as I was reading this passage this week, this story. Wells's story tells, short story tells of a mountaineer called Nunez, who is climbing up in South America, up way up in the Andes. And he's separated from his colleagues and falls, has a terrible fall, but he falls into this kind of lush, remote valley high up in the mountains. And when he comes to, when he's able to kind of muster his senses and everything like that, he discovers that this valley is populated by blind people. And he thinks, oh, I'm okay here. He remembers an old saying, which is actually the title of H.G. Wells's story. And the old saying goes, in the country of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. In the country of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. Nunez thinks that his sight is going to be a major advantage to him. Maybe even give him power, give him an authority, special status in this community. But he soon discovers that's not so. The locals think he's mad and deluded because he describes things like the sun, the sky, the moon, the stars that they've never seen and they can't understand. In the beginning, they simply want to change his perspective on things. They can't accept it. They want him to kind of, to see to see from their point of view, as it were, and they try to persuade him to have his eyes removed so that he'll be properly integrated into the group. But by the end of the story, it's got much more tense, much more difficult. They want to blind him so that he conforms to their ignorance. Nunez realizes that he can't stay there and he has to escape. Something like this is going on in our gospel reading. The Pharisees think that the healed man is mad, deluded, a blasphemer, because he's testifying to the fact that Jesus did this. And they put pressure on him to conform to their way of thinking. They refuse to accept what he has seen and experienced from among them. He becomes an outcast as far as they're concerned. Like Nunez, the man who is blind from birth, discovers that there's a cost to seeing the truth. He's rejected by the established community, the religious community, because of his refusal to conform to their way of thinking and his new perception of reality in confessing that Jesus is Lord. He's got a new take on life. He's got a new outlook. Jesus' claim to be the light of the world is one of the great I am statements in John's gospel, isn't it? There are several of them, seven of them altogether. I'm sure you can name many of them, but I am the bread of life. I am the good shepherd. I am the resurrection and the life, and so on. And all of these I am statements help to answer the central question at the heart of the gospel, and indeed at the heart of human life. Who is Jesus Christ? What does he mean for us? What's his significance for us? The very phrasing of these statements was electrifying in their first context, bringing to mind for Jews certainly the divine name revealed to Moses at the burning bush in Exodus 3. You'll remember that Moses sees this bush that is burning, and but without being consumed. And he, as he's out, looking after sheep, and he goes over towards this bush, and then suddenly he's told, "Don't come any closer. The ground on which, you take off your shoes. The ground on which you're standing is holy." And he has an encounter with God, who commissions him. God has seen the suffering of his people in Egypt, in their captivity, their slavery, and he tells Moses that he wants him to go to Pharaoh's palace and say, "Let my people go." And Moses, he's obviously taken aback by this, and he says, "Who? Well, who am I going to say sent me? Who shall I say sent me?" God's answer is to reveal his own name. Tell him, "I am who I am," has sent you. I am who I am. This is Yahweh, isn't it? That's the meaning of this strange word, Yahweh. I am who I am, or I will be who I will be. The God of Israel, the free, undetermined God of heaven and earth. So in this very construction of these sentences, "I am the light of the world. I am the bread of life," Jesus is already identifying himself with the creator of heaven and earth. And the claim to be the light of the world makes that even clearer. Jesus first makes the statement in John 8:12, "I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life." And Jesus speaks these words while he was teaching in the treasury of the temple, it says, during the Feast of Booths or the Feast of Tabernacles. And the timing of that is very, very significant. The Feast of Booths or Tabernacles, Sukkot, as it's known in Hebrew, is a festival commemorating the 40-year period that Israelites spent wandering in the wilderness after the Exodus. And it's marked, it was marked at the time of Jesus, still is today actually, by the building of temporary booths or shelters in one's garden or somewhere, to remind Jews of their sojourn in the wilderness, their temporary existence in the wilderness. But also by the lighting of four massive candelabra in the temple courtyard, symbolizing the pillar of fire by which God led the people through the wilderness. They'd light these things at night. You get young guys climbing up 75 foot or so to light these huge candelabra, four basins on each one of them. And they would light up the sky of Jerusalem at that time. And all of this was to symbolize the pillar of fire by which God led the people through the wilderness, the pillar of light. And that represented the presence of God, didn't it? In guiding, leading, protecting and teaching the people on their time in the wilderness, and also representing the glory of God, God's beauty and radiance in relation to the whole of creation. So in the context of all these biblical images and teachings, Jesus makes this profound claim about himself. He claims to be the light of life itself. As the man who was born blind discovered Jesus, following Jesus can be a challenging and profoundly countercultural business. The world can be a dark and unwelcoming place, can't it, in which to bear witness to Christ. Darkness is a strong theme in John's gospel. It's very interesting. Nicodemus comes to Jesus at night, doesn't he? He's kind of afraid of maybe comment of being seen. He does it furtively. Later on, we you know the all those chapters that are connected with the Last Supper, and then the betrayal, the arrest, the denial by Peter of Jesus, all this, and the trial itself happened at night. You know, there's a sense of darkness kind of closing in. And that we know with the world can be a dark and unwelcoming place in which to bear witness. It can be very much the place of the fake, the forged, the false, unwilling to face up to reality and allow the light of truth to break in. This is very much a concern of our times, isn't it? You know, the way in which the internet is absolutely deluged with falsehoods and fakery and stuff that's meant to deceive, as well as great stuff that's illuminating and truth-telling. But the world can be a place of fakery and forgery. It can be a place of profound spiritual blindness, masquerading as wisdom and truth and insight, as was the case with the religious tribunal, these folks who set themselves up as the great arbiters of truth in Israel, and they couldn't see the truth that was standing there in front of them. The world can be a place where the pressure to conform to its vision of reality seems absolutely overwhelming. But as this man discovers in the story, long story though it is, but very worth reading all of a piece, I think. Jesus is the light of the world. And as the prologue to John's gospel declares, he is the light who lightens everyone coming into the world. His light shines in the darkness, and the darkness cannot overcome it. His promise to that man, to his followers at that time, and to his followers today, to us, is the same as it ever was. Whoever follows me, Jesus says, will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. That's a great thing to remember in our daily kind of conflicts with authorities of one kind or another, political ideas, crazy stuff that comes our way. But even sometimes within our own midst, where friends, family are, you know, unwilling to kind of face up to the truth about a situation, about the way things are, the reality of things, and above all, the reality of Christ. And to remember that Jesus' promise to us is that whoever follows him will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. I believe we're going to have some discussion. Is that right? And you know, discussion of the passage. So I'll hand it back over to you, and you can take it from there.